Hey, thanks for coming. I'm glad you're here. Come on in. Everyone's out on the patio right now. Looks like a couple of people are in the garden. I can't wait to introduce you. Can I get you anything? Hey, folks, our new guest is here. Hello, world, and welcome to Jala-chan's Place. I'm your host, Jala Prendes, and today I am joined by Slade, he, him, and Alex, he, him, both of whom have been on this show before. So, welcome back to both of you. How are you doing today, Slade?
I seem to be a recurring character in this saga at this point.
When it comes to certain types of media, yes. You were on for Batman,
I was on
so.
for Batman, yes.
It's been a minute. It's been a minute. So, how are you
I'm
doing?
noticing a certain theme, though. The Batman, Phantom of the Opera.
Slade
It's dark and spooky. Get Slade in here.
has not answered my question about how he's doing today, notably, but okay. So, Slade is doing dark and spooky. That's fitting for the month of October. And this episode is going to be coming out on the 28th, right before Halloween, anyway. So, just in time. You are in the right mood, sir. So, Alex, how are you doing?
Doing pretty good. It's been a week of an amazing amount of work, and it's Friday afternoon, and I spent my off time reading the Phantom of the Opera this week, so seems worthwhile.
Is it, or is it just like you need a Shay Lounge to go faint on because, you know,
Sure.
like the original LaRue is just so melodramatic?
Yeah. A hammock to nap in, but I will throw a dramatic arm out of the hammock
There
and
you go.
gesture wildly.
There's a weird fusion of themes.
You need a little fan in your hand so you can just like fan yourself. Although you're in a cold place, that would not be a good idea this time. For me, it's like it's hot. It's like 85-ish right now.
Yeah, it's 90 today where I am.
Yeah, 85 is actually nice. Like this isn't as anyway, that's not the point. Okay, today we are talking about the Phantom of the Opera, as Slade already spoiled for today. So what we're going to talk about is the original LaRue novel a little bit, the 1910 novel, as well as the 1991 book Phantom by Susan Kay, which actually is considered to be Phantom canon, and it expounds upon the little kernels of information that LaRue gives you in his novel and gives all of the characters, like breathes a lot more life into them and gives them a much more compassionate read. And it is so hammy. It is so gothic horror, melodrama, you know, telenovela times 70, you know, romance, all of that. Anyway, so a little bit about LaRue. He was a court reporter and a theater critic. And eventually he became an international correspondent, and his brother was a musician. So he was actually, when he wrote The Phantom of the Opera, known as a crime writer. He wrote novels, like he had already written a detective mystery called The Mystery of the Yellow Room in 1907. And so he was already well known internationally as a crime mystery author, inspired by Edgar Allan Poe and Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. So that's an interesting mixture.
It's very apparent too in
Yes.
places. Yeah.
Yes. So, and you know, honestly, even the fact that he was a court reporter and an international correspondent and a theater critic, all of that shows, in my opinion, when you look at the way that he writes his original novel, like it's kind of sparse in a lot of ways, in a way that I would expect from somebody who's just doing like a brief report on something.
It feels like it's a, as you said, it feels like it's like a, like a news article almost, in a
Yeah.
way.
Well, it's kind of trying to, because that was kind of in vogue at the time. Like, oh, these are the reports, and I assure you that these are a credible source. You know, like I found these documents, and now I'm reporting to you about what happened at the opera. And this actually was inspired because he was the court reporter for a case involving an investigation of the former Paris Opera, the basement of it had a cell that held prisoners of the Paris Commune, a radical socialist government that ruled from March 18th to May 27th of 1871.
Yeah. That was during the Franco-Prussian War, right? Or in the aftermath of?
Yeah, somewhere around there. I don't remember exactly where. But yeah, so in either case, like, he kind of took that, lifted it, put it there, and then made a gothic romance mystery horror something out of it.
What if there was a dramatic man hiding under the in the basement?
A dramatic man who, well, I mean, like, his original version, they keep on calling it a death's head, and you know, like, the description of what Eric looks like is so ghastly. But I will tell you that the Susan Kay Phantom book from 1991 goes into even more depth about how, you know, gruesome he looks in a way that I feel works for her very telenovela dramatic, you know, fashion of
Susan
writing.
Kay really makes it sound like you can literally see his skull almost, which is kind of terrifying to consider.
Well, I mean, like, I think at one point she even talks about how, you know, his skin is almost translucent. He's super skeletal, tall, and with fingers that are super bony. And, like, she always talks about how cold he is, like death, and all this other stuff, to where it's like, oh no, actually he's really creepy, and not just like his face. And also,
his entire demeanor is very unsettling, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and not only that, but just...
No, I'm just... That's very much how he felt to me reading the novel, right? Mm-hmm. You know, in the terms of, like, our video game friends, he's like a effed up little guy in the novel. And he's very much not that when you're looking at the musicals and the you know, the Andrew Lloyd Webber, the you know, masculine hero, you know, anti-hero of the drama, right?
Especially, like, I think, like, since the, like, especially the 90s and onwards, he's kind of, the character's been much more romanticized than previously. I remember when I was a child one year, you know, I don't know if everyone else remembers those old magazines we used to get where all the toys and the Merry Freaking Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
There was one year where they had a set of Barbie dolls that were literally, like, the Phantom, Christine, and Raoul, and, of course, it's literally just
Ken
a reskin.
And Barbie, and, like, Midge, or whatever her name was.
Exactly, yeah. And it's literally just a reskinned Ken doll with a mask. Yeah. You take it off, it's like, oh, look, there's some lines on his face.
Right. Yes. Exactly. Yeah.
Well, and the thing is that I think over time what happened is that, okay, so Phantom as a concept of, like, this disfigured or, you know, ghoulish kind of apparition, hell demon man who has all of this capacity in that kind of attractive Lucifer devil who can do everything and is, you know, really wise or whatever, as, like, calling to mankind to, you know, call them to the dark side or whatever. Like, that concept has just stayed with us, and there's so many different ways in which just Phantom is everywhere. You can find references to it almost ubiquitously. It's just like a mimetic, you know, like a cultural thing now that's just in there. It's in the zeitgeist at this point. But,
you know, now that you mentioned it, something just occurred to me. There's, in episode 3 of the Star Wars films, there's actually a scene where it's kind of like the sealing of the deal between Anakin and Palpatine, and it happens at an opera, and I'm kind of looking at that going, wait a minute, Lucas, did you sneak that in there? You like your references. Is that what that is?
Well, you know what another one would be Bilbo lusting after the ring, and, you know, like, it's my, you know, like, that whole Lon Chaney look, right? It's like an archetype that's been... A century of movies have played off of that, right?
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And
one look at that, I was like, oh yeah, that's where this comes from. It's this.
Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah. So, like, the concept of the character has just been with us for a long time. But, like, I feel especially since the 90s, especially since, like, Anne Rice stuff got super, super popular, that Phantom stuff kind of got melded with this concept. And the concept really of just, like, a lot of horror for certain folks for a long time. Like, vampires are attractive, and now werewolves are attractive, and also there's a Phantom, and he's attractive. And it's like he's just got, like, a burn scar on the other side of his face. That's
exactly. There's actually something I really like about Kay's novel specifically that you don't see in a lot of the movies or in even some of the other, you know, novelizations that have happened, is that it really because in the Kay novels, of course, we know how worn down he is by the end. By the time of the operatic incident, that's all he, you know, it's towards the end of his life. It's towards, he's worn down after everything he's been through. And it shows in Kay's novel in a way that we don't always get to see in other expressions of the character. So often he's portrayed as almost otherworldly and, you know, vampiric, you know, like you mentioned. But in Kay's novel, she humanizes him and shows that, yes, he's still incredibly intelligent, incredibly powerful, but he has deteriorated. He is very much decayed from all the experiences he's had throughout his life.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So it's interesting because when the Kay novel starts, it's from the point of view of Eric's mother, Madeline, and she gives birth and she's all hopeful. Her husband has died. She's a young bride who doesn't know how to do anything for herself and is really childlike herself. And she gives birth and she's all hopeful. And then out pops Eric, and she is so horrified and terrified that she wants to kill it. She doesn't want to feed. Well, actually, she wants to just not feed the baby.
The midwife runs away and is never heard from again.
Yeah.
Isn't that what she says? Yeah.
And I think, if I remember correctly, if I remember the start of the book correctly, doesn't she even ask the priest, the town priest, like, can I just kill it? Can we kill it? Let it be a mercy killing?
She was like, well, if I just stop feeding him, or if I just don't feed him. And then the priest was just like, we're not doing that because you're Catholic. And that's like, you know,
yeah,
you can't do that.
No infanticide for you.
And then he's like, well, you've got to give your son a name. And then she's like, I don't care. Name him after yourself, because she doesn't want to call him anything.
And I think it's so interesting. Like, I read that book originally, obviously, when you introduced me to it years ago. Reading it again now, it just reinforces the whole concept of, like, you know, I really have to wonder, it's like, how much of this is Eric, like, how much of his nature that we see throughout the book is Eric just being Eric versus Eric dealing with all the traumatic bullshit his mother put him through?
So it's, yeah, like, at first, Madeline talks about Eric in terms of the thing, and she immediately put a mask on him. And the only reason why she ended up feeding him, because she was so terrified and whatever, is just because even as an infant, she noticed that when he cried, it was super melodious, and his eyes, which are misaligned, still have like a light in them that captures her. You know, like, he's got this otherworldly power that immediately everybody is like, he's a devil child, but he's a baby. He's innocent. You can't kill him. He didn't do anything, you know, and so on. So that he's alive, but, you know, he definitely has like a supernatural power that is laid out at the beginning of the book. It hits his voice. So like, he cries and then his mom will feed him. And then the moment he stops crying, she freaks out and bats him away. And like, she, you know, he's abused so badly, like emotionally, physically.
It isn't just batting him away. Doesn't she like literally throw him?
I don't remember if she threw him or if she just like knocked him off her chest. I don't know what exactly happened.
Bad enough either way.
yeah. So something that was interesting to me, which I only realized when I was going back to the beginning to flip through it again, is that coincidentally, okay, so Madeline, Eric's father, Madeline's husband, who died before this book begins, his name is Charles. Charles is the name of Christine's son at the end of the book. So that's actually, and it's interesting because at the end of the book, when Raoul is talking about Charles, he's saying, yeah, he doesn't look like me or Christine. He looks like these people in these photographs, which are like some, or not photographs, I guess it would be portraits or whatever, portraits of Eric's parents that he had that Christine kept with her. And so Charles is son of Eric and Christine and looks like the perfect child that should have been, basically.
Yeah, which is an interesting theme to end the book on, honestly, in a way. It's like, here's that child that the mother always wanted.
Mm-hmm. Named after the husband, the way that she wanted to originally name Eric.
Yep.
And then not only that, but this character, you know, this character for the brief moment that you see or hear about him is basically somebody that Raoul relies on implicitly and who is very kind and gentle, but he's also super attractive, but he's also musically gifted and all this.
It's essentially, it's very much implied that like essentially he is the combination of Christine's beauty with also all the talents of his father, you know, Eric.
Yeah.
The Phantom.
Yep. Yep. But that is jumping like all the way ahead. It's just that if I didn't mention that right now, I would have forgotten all about it by the time we got to that.
Of course.
But the K novel talks about how, you know, Eric lived this super abused life at home, but he had this capacity to fascinate people with his voice. And he has the capacity to throw his voice, like he learns ventriloquism and he starts learning magic tricks and, you know, all this other stuff because he's kept at home. He's never taken out of the house. He's shut up all the time. There are times when his mom will like leave him to go to town and locks him in a closet and stuff like that. So super, super child abuse going on there. And eventually there's like an incident where his dog dies and he gets really upset because the dog was the only entity, like living being, that just loved him and, you know, wasn't judgmental about how he looked. And so he's heartbroken, and then he ends up leaving after a big fight with his mom, and because he wants to actually like go out in the world and try to do stuff, and she's like, you can't, not looking like that, you can't. And he's like, bye. And so off he goes. He gets captured by gypsies and then is put in a cage and then touted around as a sideshow for a long time until he coaxes his slave owner to say, well, how about we negotiate? You get me out of this cage and let me have a tent and I will do this, 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 and this. I will sing, I will do tricks, I will do whatever, and then I will show them my face because you require that I do that. And eventually he ends up gaining like power among the Romani people because of just like, again, his capacity to do literally everything. Hmm. So, so Slade, like, what did you feel about the beginning of how all of that set up? I mean, he was learning architecture stuff because his dad was an architect. And, you know, masonry, and he learned a little bit of that. He picked up drawing skills. He picked up ventriloquism. He picked up music and all this other stuff, you know, at home.
Holy Master of Phantom.
Yeah, like this is all like nascent Phantom for real. Like he's getting most of his stuff, except for like some of the later skills that get honed in. It's really, really crucial, but the way that it's written is so dramatic.
Yeah, it's all very formative. Like almost every single skill he later uses, especially during the actual incident at the opera house, you can very much see the formative moments of all those skills he has, all those talents, all those interests in his childhood as he's learning all these different skills. You know, architecture he takes from his father's library. You know, he learns how to be a ventriloquist, like you mentioned. I think it's because his nanny gave him a book at one point, I believe.
I think for his birthday or something.
Yeah, I think that's what it was. And he also learns a fascination with mirrors, which leads into another part of the book, which is incredibly dark and kind of blends into his callousness towards human life. But one of the things I actually wanted to mention was when he actually leaves his mother's house, it isn't just because of you know, the fight they have, because they do have that argument of how he hates being locked away, how, you know, the villagers murdered his dog and he's furious at them and wants to hurt them. And just there's all these things that happen. But one of the thoughts he has as he is leaving is an interesting one, especially contrasted with how he can be portrayed very much as a very selfish and, you know, self-centered character. One of his first thoughts upon leaving is that his mother is now safe. His mother can have a normal life. And he is happy for her to do so.
Oh, and yeah, like you can put a pin in that because later on in the book, he comes back and he finds out what really happened, because like his mom also has like a love interest. There's a doctor that's interested in marrying her and she might have a chance at a normal life in the village with everyone else and all of that. And that's what Eric is imagining for her at this point. Yep. he's thinking, well, if I leave, then she has the ability to go out there and go, you know, do all of this stuff. So I need to go away because this is just going to imprison her forever, just like I'm imprisoned here. And at one point, he actually uses his voice, throws his voice into like a little angel figurine. And then his mom starts to, you know, talk about, like, starts losing it and is like, this is my baby, and puts it in the crib and does all this other stuff because
basically bewitches her, essentially. And
yeah, he breaks her mind. And that's part of what he realizes is, not only is she being abusive to me, I have broken her. I need to go, you know? So,
yeah, exactly.
And that's kind of like the repeating pattern that happens throughout all of the Susan K. novel. I will say, just taking a pause, it was written in 91. It was reprinted around the time of the Gerard Butler movie version of the Andrew Lloyd Webber musical. And then it was never reprinted again. There does not exist a purchasable ebook, but there is an ebook out there, a PDF you can Google for. And also you can still buy paperbacks and hardbacks, but I think it's out of print and you have to buy old copies. So
yeah, I'm pretty sure if you want to actually get your hand on the book, it has to be a used copy at this point.
Yeah. Yeah. So just a heads up, like if what you're already hearing sounds cool to you, you're probably going to need to go and look up, see if you can find a book, or there is, again, like a copy that somebody scanned of it or printed it off a webpage. I don't know where they got it from, but anyway, there is a PDF out there if you want to Google for it. So Alex, how does all of this sound? I know you only got...
I love it so much. You are so, like, I've only read the first 50 pages of the K novel, but I read the LaRue novel, which I just got from Project Gutenberg. You can just go download it. And it's an amazing copy or rendition, or translation, I guess. It's written in French originally. You know, like, one of the things I noticed is that it calls the original, when they talk about the prison beneath the opera, they call them the communist prison.
Mm-hmm.
I think communard would be the proper term for that. Right, because they didn't have communists in 1872 making a revolution in France. That didn't happen. It was like, oh, wait, hold on. And like, it has like interesting little details, like occasionally printing lines in all capitals for no appreciable reason, which kind of makes it this, it's ironically enjoyable to see that. This is like everything that you've said is a summary of the epilogue of the LaRue novel, where he basically says everything that you've talked about. You know, Eric was born to, you know, his mom, his dad was a stonemason, he was traveled with the Roma, you know, circus or whatever he was doing there, had a job underneath what do they call them?
The Ottomans?
Yes, yes, indeed. As like the builder of trapdoors and all that stuff. But the way that you mentioned, I mean, like, I feel like the way that you put it originally was perfect, right? It is kind of like partially a journalism kind of account, right? Partially a melodrama, partially a gothic romance, partially a work of, detective fiction, right? With Arthur Conan Doyle. And it kind of does all of these things. And it kind of really impressed upon me as I read it that everything that it's doing is kind of a conglomeration of these popular styles of fiction at the time, right? And at the time, I mean, very early 20th century.
Oh,
so when it was published, like 1910, 1915,
1910.
Like yeah. And so like, oh, well, Arthur Conan Doyle was a force in popular fiction at the time. So was like gothic fiction like Poe. So was like all of these things play a huge part in like kind of what you get out of reading Phantom of the Opera, right?
Yeah.
Like, almost kind of in order, you know? It's like, he starts it out like, oh, yes, I have, this is the journalistic account of what happened at the Paris Opera, and I applied to all the people in the know, and they said I was right. Right? Like, that's kind of how he starts. And then it becomes this incredible, like an expose, almost, of, like, what is it like in the opera with the members of the ballet and the, you know, all the people that open and close the doors and provide the gas for the fireworks and ring the curtains up and down and all the, you know, all the backstage stuff, right? It kind of feels like a, we're going to bring you inside this place that you might not know that well, right? And from there, it veers into, you know, and to describe the plot, right? It's a story of, you know, the Paris Opera, you know, the investigation made by Monsieur Leroux, and how the opera ghost, right, who, you know, who's the subject of rumor among the members of the opera, becomes the focus of the actual plot of the novel when he starts interfering in the production of the operas that are going on, right? So he says stuff like, you will have Christine Daae sing rather than the original Marguerite in Faust when you put it on, and you'll also start giving me money. I'm blackmailing you. And he's causing these demands to be put upon the owners and managers of the opera. And there's, you know, this kind of investigation. There's reluctance on the part of the owners. And from there, it just kind of takes this turn into Christine, right? As she, you know, Carlotta, the, you know, prima donna of the opera, finds that she can't perform. She says a coack. She tries to sing a line. She completely implodes. This is after a threat from the opera ghost that Christine should sing instead. And the chandelier crashes upon the audience. There's chaos and mayhem. And everyone realizes that the opera ghost is kind of playing a larger part in the way that the opera is being performed than everyone thought. Everyone thought that he was like, the reason box number 5 is empty is because of the opera ghosts. It's a romantic kind of thing that's happening here at the Paris Opera. Isn't that wildly appropriate? Actually, people were being killed. There was a worker at the opera who was found hanged also. And the implication in the journalistic side of things is that he found out too much and the opera ghost did away with him.
Okay, so I did want to say that one thing that's interesting to me is that just occurred to me while I was listening to you, Alex, was that this book, like the original LaRue novel, has this detective character, Nadir, or the Persian, or Daroga, depending upon what you want to call him.
Daroga is kind of like chief, right? Like kind of.
He's chief of police.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the interesting thing about that character, though, is that he's the detective in this setting.
Yeah.
And he is trying to, you know, pursue Eric. But the framework of this novel is such that the detective is not the main character. So even though it is a detective story, it's not focusing on the detection or any of that. It's focusing on this love thing that's going on over there. And then like the antagonist that is trying to be caught, but like not directly from Eric's point of view. It's, you know, like this thing that's focusing on like these two people at the opera and what's going on with that. And like the detection part of it is kind of like the sideline to all the other stuff that's being paraded in the novel.
I really love that about it in the sense that, it really felt like it's like we can't have Raoul is way too flighty to be the guy who gets out of the situation. We need a more straightforwardly.
A more efficient character.
Yes,
perhaps?
We need someone who has some practical skills, not like Raoul who just fires pistols at the foot of his bed when he gets spooked. Right. We need we have this other guy, but it kind of changes the, you would expect a gothic romance to have a love triangle at the center of it, right? Which is Raoul, Eric, Christine. But the second half of the novel, it's kind of like the actual triangle is Raoul, Eric, and the Persian, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it's like, oh, who's this guy? And he's kind of like replaced Christine as kind of the focus of the novel in the second half of it.
It is definitely a very unorthodox way to approach it. I actually had a funny thought just now. Jarlot was mentioning how this is kind of this does have that detective story theme to it, only we're not seeing it from the detective's point of view. We're seeing it from, you know, the pursuers or the pursuant's point of view, Eric in this case. And I'm kind of wondering if the manga and anime like series Lupin the Third take a little inspiration from that. Cause that's basically the whole premise there is, though, we're not following the detective, we're following the thief.
Yeah. Yeah, it could be because so many things actually take inspiration from this book. And the funny thing is that the LaRue original novel, I read it when I was young, after I watched the Lon Chaney movie. The Lon Chaney movie was my first introduction to Phantom, which is actually a pretty accurate, you know, like probably the most accurate rendition of it in some other format that is not a book format. And I, you know, watched that movie. That was my first introduction to Phantom. I decided to read the original novel. I read the novel and I was like disappointed because I was like, I don't really like these characters, like any of them. I can't really get into the style. It's kind of weird. This stuff just kind of gets like hinted at, but it's never explained. And I mean, I understand if you're a court reporter, you're not going to get all of the other details behind like how we get to this point. You just are presenting facts and that's what you get. And that's what, you know, is happening
it's,
here.
It's so weird though, right? Because it does that some of the time, right? It's like just the facts.
And then it goes for paragraphs and other points. Like, yeah.
I'm going to have an entire, you know, five pages of dialogue that's all Christine. Oh, Christine, I like that, just literally that on the page. Right? Like it kind of changes tone wildly at times.
Yes,
it does. And I remember I read it originally. It was actually, oddly enough, and I fully admit, I apparently set my difficulty to hard when I did this. The Phantom was actually one of the first books I ever read after I learned to read.
Okay.
Yeah, no, I don't know. I don't know why for the life of me that was the book I read. I don't remember why.
Parents were literary folks?
This is true, but it wasn't them. It was a book that was just sitting in my classroom when I was like in third grade. Cause I was okay. I learned to read the year before third grade. I was slow. And for some reason that was in my classroom. And that was the first book I chose to read when I got back to school after having learned.
Okay.
And I had a very similar experience to Jala because I knew of the Phantom. I'd seen the musical as a child. My parents took me to see it. And I'd seen the Lon Chaney film as well. So I was familiar with it, and I liked it. And I read the book, and I remember being so, like, kind of almost put off by the book.
And, you know, I reread the book multiple times after that. Like, I read it when I was young, and then, like, every, I don't know, 5 to 10 years or so, I would pick it up and read it again, probably more like 5 years. Every 5 years, I would pick this up and read it again and go, nope, still don't like it. Nope, still don't like it. I kept on going, I don't like this book, but I like the Andrew, like, eventually I got into the Andrew Lloyd Webber music, or, you know, like, mm-hmm. Broadway musical. And then when the 2004 movie came out, I was like, okay, Gerard Butler is way too pretty to be Eric the way that he's supposed to be. However, he's easy on the eyes, and that's fine. I'm like in college, I'll take it, you know.
I will say that, you know, while Gerard Butler is definitely too pretty to be the role, even when he takes the mask off, it's like, oh look, you're badly burned, doesn't look that bad, dude. He does bring a certain energy and passion to the role, which is oftentimes I find kind of, I've seen a couple different actors do the Broadway play now, and Gerard Butler has a passion in his role as the Phantom and Eric that a lot of stage actors don't really seem to bring to it for mm-hmm. whatever reason.
Yeah, I've seen a couple of different renditions of Eric on, you know, like in the musical version, and nobody else does. Like, okay, Gerard Butler is not Mr. Best Singing Man, but no. He is definitely, like, definitely brings the energy of Eric, like the intensity that you would imagine from a broken genius.
Exactly.
And he hits that on the head real hard and gets that, you know, nailed in real, you know, dialed in real good. So, but yeah, his prettiness is definitely, I feel directly linked to like Anne Rice, Interview with the Vampire, Pretty Boys, and yeah, you know, later on stuff like Twilight happens.
It's time.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, later on you get Twilight. So, I mean, like, it's like an ongoing, you got to have the pretty dangerous supernatural critters of horror, you know?
I always like, there's several novels that do this that I've read over the years. When it comes to, we were talking about Anne Rice and vampires in general briefly. I always like, and The Phantom in a way is kind of a parable of this. That idea that, yes, it's all pretty and everything, but it, like, the moment you piss it off or if it reveals its true self, oh shit.
And that's something that Susan Kaye, to go back to the Susan Kaye novel, that's something that she does really, really well, is express how like, you don't ever get a sense that he's just acting irrationally for no reason whatsoever. Like, he's just an intense personality and has been since a child. He gets very fixated on things, and then he flies into an intense emotion either one way or the other, like 100% into a thing because he is busy on a task and he will work himself to death trying to finish it and make it perfect. And he's obsessed with perfection because he himself is imperfect in the eyes of everyone around him. And so, like, you know, he's super obsessed with that. Or, you know, he flies into a rage if he's interrupted, if something doesn't go right, if somebody says no, he's just like, what? You know, like, this, you know, he's focused on control because he doesn't have any control of himself or his capacity to be out in the world, really. Because he keeps on attempting to make forays into the world in the Susan K. novel. And every time he does, some shit happens. And it ends up going really, really poorly. And he has to move on. And he has to keep on moving on. And he just gets so tired by the end of the novel. Because after the Romani thing, he was with the Romani. The slave driver, actually, at one point, when he gets old enough, decides that he looks, you know, he would be interesting to have. And so the slave driver wants to physically, sexually assault him.
Yep.
Out of fear in being completely innocent, having no idea what's going on, Eric ends up killing the guy.
He's still a child at the time, too, I think, right?
Yeah, he is. Correctly? That was his first. He was like 13, maybe. Like, yeah. You know, something like that. And after that, there is a Romani girl who is missing. Everybody's like, oh my God, where'd she go? Well, she had a lover that was not Romani, which meant that she was going to be banished if she, you know, was caught. Eric, because everybody was worried, went looking for her because he didn't want her to be hurt somewhere by herself. Finds her, and then he's like, you know, come on, come with me, you know, and all this. And then she's like, I'm going to tell everybody that you assaulted me. And he knows that everybody is going to turn on him because he's not Romani and he's like the quote unquote freak show, you know? So
who are they going to believe, right?
Yeah. Who are they going to believe, the Romani girl or him? So then at that point, he ends up getting shoved off from the Romani. And then he ends up coming across, when he's just wandering kind of aimlessly, he ends up coming across a stonemason and architect who is, you know, like, hasn't had an apprentice in a very long time, but he notices Eric just on the construction site looking at, you know, his work and super, super interested in everything, and is like, huh, well, you know, let's see how talented he is. And then when he realizes that Eric is so talented, he's like, I will absolutely have him as my apprentice. I haven't had an apprentice in forever because nobody has the work ethic or the talent, but I will have him as my apprentice. But then the stonemason's daughter, who is very spoiled and is very much like Madeline, Eric's mom, comes to live with him. And she ends up becoming obsessed with Eric, just wants him to take off the mask, is always wondering what he's doing, is kind of in love with him, but kind of just curious and being selfish.
She has a very, to a context a lot of people will probably understand, it's very much a Veruca Salt kind of character.
Yeah, yeah. So he, Eric, is actually like in puppy love with her too, just because he hasn't been around women his own age, you know? So anyway, at one point, they're in the rooftop garden and she corners him and says, I want you to take off that mask. And then the father slash master mason or whatever comes out, and because he's just darn sick of these children, you know, just driving everybody crazy and also just like wasting away and suffering and whatever, he's just like, Eric, just take off the mask, okay? Just do it. And Eric, you know, that breaks his trust with Eric, because that was the one thing that Eric didn't want anybody to tell him to do. And that's the one thing that they all, of course, wanted him to do. The girl, in a fit of emotional temper tantrum, runs away and then ends up when she's like goes up against the side railing or whatever, some of the stone masonry just breaks and she falls to her death. So pretty obviously Eric leaves that situation.
I don't remember. Doesn't she see his face in her fear? That's what makes her run.
Yeah, that's what it is. That's what it is. She sees his face because he's like, fine, you want to see it? Fine.
Yeah, exactly. He takes it off, and I think I don't remember if she actually runs or backs up. Like, I don't know what it is. Like, she backs up to like a part of the rail that's damaged, it gives way, and then she falls, unfortunately.
Well, he's not trying to get anywhere near her. She's just so scared that she just backs up and backs up and backs up. Or
Eric doesn't do anything directly to her. She gets what she wants, and oh shit.
Yeah. So, but he has picked up stonemasonry by that point. And then after that, he's wandering around Europe and just traveling, doing magician shows and things like that, and singing for people for a number of years.
It's amazing the number of little things he picks up, isn't it? I love it.
He very much, like, it's one of the best things about the K novel is that, because the original novel, obviously, we see him at the, you know, kind of the end of it all, in a way, where it's like, okay, this guy has all these talents and is just kind of doing everything. Whereas the K novel takes us in detail through his life and shows us how he got all these different skills and talents that we ultimately know him for.
And not only that, but in the K novel, everything feels natural to what's going on. Like, it doesn't seem like forced, like she's trying to shoehorn in a rationale for something. That's not what happens.
She develops
characters that are so complex as to feed directly into the, you know, like the end result she's looking for.
Kay actually is a, I think she only has two or three novels. Last I checked, I think she only did like two or three, you know, novels. One of them was this. I think another one was, I think it was about either Boudica or Elizabeth I. I don't remember which one she did, but she did two. She did one or two other historical fictions, I believe. But she does a great job. Something I always strive to do with my own writing as well is even her most minor random side characters feel incredibly fleshed out and fully realized, which isn't something a lot of authors are able to do. And I really applaud her for making that. You're filling her world with such characters that feel like they are realistic and not just jammed in there to fill a plot point.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so we go from that to him traveling all over the place, becoming acculturated because he's gone everywhere. And then the Shah in Persia overhears about, you know, people talking about this magician who is so magical and has all of these skills, so talented, you know, really must be seen, and decides that he wants to fetch this magician for his mother, the Khanum, to entertain her, because he's really kind of a puppet leader. She's really the leader behind Persia at this juncture. And so he sends Nadir, who is the Daroga, or the Persian, as we see him in the LaRue novel. And he travels to Russia and goes to meet Eric, tries to convince him to come back to Persia, eventually manages to do so, and then along the way back, saves Eric, and Eric saves him multiple times, and they end up forming a kind of friendship before they go back to Persia. But his character is fleshed out greatly. He had a wife that he was deeply in love with who passed away, and even though his faith is, you know, and his culture says that he can have up to three wives at a time, he never remarried anybody, and he only has one son, Reza, who is sickly and looks just like the mom. So, you know, Nadir dotes on him, but also he's sick and he doesn't know what to do. When Eric sees Reza, goes, I'm so sorry, because he realizes that Reza is dying. He's not going to live for very much longer. And so Eric, without being asked, just on his own, out of compassion, decides that he's going to slave away and make all of these different like toys for him and entertain him and tell him stories and basically make his last days as happy as he can. And Nadir gets jealous of him for a while because, you know, he feels like his son was taken away by this random stranger who showed up. But when eventually Reza ends up having to pass away, and he's starting to go downhill, and he's like at the point where he doesn't have a quality of life anymore. Eric offers to Nadir, here, if you give him this, he will have a quiet slumber and he will pass away. And Nadir is not strong enough to do it in that moment, so Eric does it for him and, you know, helps give his son a peaceful death. So they have like this really, really strong bond that goes beyond, you know, concepts of right and wrong. Like the Daroga does not believe in all of the deaths that Eric causes. And, you know, all of the fact that Eric is like, the moment he walks into the Shah's palace, he is going up to the peacock throne and prizing diamonds out of it and replacing them with cut glass and keeping them for himself. And, you know, because he's like an incessant pickpocket and thief, and he steals stuff wherever he goes. So
it's kind of just how he's learned to survive, honestly.
It's basically how he learned to survive. And so, like, when he goes to see the Khanum is interested in making him perform, like, because she's just, I don't know, twisted. Didn't she, Slade, originally want him to perform sexually for her? And then when that wasn't a thing, he's like, no. Then she ends up having him kill people. And that's how he, you know, it starts with the Punjab lasso and the torture machines and stuff.
What happens is, you know, you're right. Initially, you know, she demands, essentially wants to turn him into a concubine, which he obviously refuses. And then essentially this woman is essentially kind of, I jokingly say, she's like the architect for all the huts you read about in Star Wars, because there's several huts who basically take a lot of points from her. She basically essentially starts having him almost hunt, you know, quote unquote, guests that she brings, damn servants, etc. And eventually she gets bored of the, you know, the simple lasso stuff, so she asks him to escalate, and he escalates with different gadgets and traps. And at one point, if I remember correctly, he actually builds her like a full-on-ass death maze with, like, yeah, mirrors and traps and all kinds of horrors. Mm-hmm. And it's on the one hand, it's a wonderful testament to the character's, you know, Eric's intelligence and brilliance as a designer and architect and all this other stuff, and as a magician, too. But on the other hand, it's like, it really drives home that sense of just, he does not have a value of human life. He doesn't understand the value of human life. To him, this is all just, you know, he is a spider entertaining his mistress in this case, and these are all the flies he's collected.
Well, a couple of things there. First off, the fact that he uses mirrors is important because the mirror setup with K-Book is at the very beginning. Like, he's fascinated with mirrors and terrified of them, yep, and they are a theme throughout the entire book. So anytime a mirror shows up, you know, that's important. The use of the word spider, like, spiders are brought up as imagery and as direct, direct metaphor. This is this at multiple points in the book as well.
Well, it's actually, one of the you'd say most traumatic moments for him as a child too, is when his mother rips off his mask and holds up a mirror to him.
Mm-hmm.
And for whatever reason, you know, she never has the courage or strength of character to tell him, that's your face. You look like that. She tells him instead, that's a monster. If you keep the mask on, it will keep the monster away, which kind of begins his fascination with mirrors. He associates both his mask, as a child at least, his mask and mirrors with magic, which is, you know, obviously what he carries on in part working for the Ottomans.
Mm-hmm. Well, and another thing I wanted to comment is that's the second time we've heard a Star Wars comment. So, like, maybe there's more, yeah, DNA here with, you know, some influences than we originally might have thought. So, Alex, you are tittering.
I'm just amused because it's kind of like, I got that far in the K novel. And she says, like, well, I scarred him for life.
Yes.
Yeah, she's just like, oh well.
It's like very, it's like, yep. Well, that did it.
The mother is so callous and uncaring towards, yeah, him. It's like I have a very strong parental drive. I'm very good with kids. I care about them very deeply. I will literally just like, ooh, mine now. I will take care of you. And so, reading the mother is just kind of horrifying to me.
It strikes me that a mother that was like that would not have the insight to be able to say to write something like that too.
Yeah.
So the thing with her is, like, it's this, and this rubs off on Eric in a big way. It's why he's so infatuated with Christine later on.
Yeah.
Madeline, the mother, is incredibly shallow in her affections. Like, she is an intelligent woman. She's well-educated. She mentions multiple times in her part of the book that she puts on the facade of, you know, a bubble-headed young woman just to, you know, look pretty to everybody. But she is intelligent. And so she is both simultaneously aware of the abuse she's doing to him while also despising him because, in her mind, he is nothing but hideous monstrosity. It's makes what she does to him, honestly, in my mind, all the more horrifying.
Well, the thing about Madeline is that she is, we have to separate this out here, she is head smart. She is not emotionally intelligent.
Correct.
And so that's where there's a giant disconnect because, you know, she was hoping for this perfect baby in this perfect setting with her perfect husband until he died. And then all this other stuff happened and now we're here. But, yeah, that character of Madeline is echoed in the stonemason. I think his name is Giovanni.
I believe so. I think I can't remember his daughter. I never remember the daughter's
Luciana.
Name. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, and Giovanni's daughter, Luciana, she's the same way. That's like Eric's first love. And then, you know, when he sees Christine, Kay even says that Christine looks like his mom. So, the one thing he wanted from his mom that he never got was a kiss. For his birthday 1 year, when he was like, I think five, he wanted a kiss and he asked for a kiss. And Madeline said, no, you can't, I'm not going to give you that. You know, you can't ask for that. You know, he's wanted affection from his mom or mom surrogate. And he's found a couple of mom surrogates over the years who are like how she was. And one of them happens to be Christine. Hmm.
It's interesting and, you know, kind of very sad, tragic, just how much both the beauty of his mother and also just the abuse of his mother sticks with him throughout the entire arc of his character.
Yeah, absolutely. But then again, that's kind of to be expected because his mother was his entire world, along with his dog.
Yeah, because, I mean, well, especially, I think, I don't remember how old he was when he left. I think it was like 10 or 11, however old he was when he fled. Essentially, he only had like a half dozen people in his life at most. There was the mother, the maid, the dog, obviously.
The priest. And that's
the priest.
Like, and I think like one mason guy.
Yeah, I think there was an architect who came to visit him.
And who taught him a little bit when he was at home yet. Yeah.
And the thing, speaking of the architect, you know, it's so, it just echoes that line of just the treatment of the mother, how she brings in the architect to satiate Eric's mind, and then simultaneously also drives him out again when she's like, no, stop teaching him the horrible stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're giving him tools to torture me. Stop that.
Yeah.
He's going to start him with the trapdoors and stuff. Can't have that.
I think it was the mirrors specifically, if I remember correctly.
Well, so that's the thing about the mirrors, to pull it all the way back to Persia and what Eric's doing there. So let me just go ahead and resolve the rest of what's going on there, and then we can talk about the mirrors. So he also at the same time was building a new palace for the Shah. While this was going on, the Grand Vizier was hating on Eric because Eric could do whatever he wanted and all of that. Eventually, the Grand Vizier, who had many, many enemies because he was very progressive and wanted to do more for the people, eventually he got killed, and his wife, who truly loved him, who is the sister of the Shah, was remarried immediately with no mourning period to a new person who was the new Grand Vizier. And this sent Eric into a complete rage because he does not hurt women. He does not hurt children. That's his rule. And, he was upset because they just disregarded her completely. And they had been, you know, the Vizier and the woman had been completely in love, you know, all of this. So at a very public function, he completely just disses the new Grand Vizier and says something about, oh, hopefully he's better with his secondhand earnings or something like that. That just sets him as a mark for assassins because they're not going to tolerate that kind of disrespect from just a common person or a court magician.
Yeah, because that is how he's viewed. He's viewed kind of as a court curiosity.
Yeah.
I have no read on how realistic any of this stuff is.
It doesn't really matter. I mean, like, it starts out with this whole super drama of, like, my supernatural baby. There's a certain point to where you just gotta go with it.
No, I get that.
The palace politics.
It's just that, like, the part of it that's like, here's the opera house and here's the back, the ballerinas and the managers, and, like, that is all cast in this very straightforward journalistic thing. And then when it comes and in the Ottoman court, they have torture rooms full of trapdoors and mirrors and strangle nooses. And, like, I don't think that any of that is wrong. I don't think that that's, like, incorrect totally, but it's just kind of like this. I don't know how seriously to take it, right?
Yeah, the court politics of the Ottoman arc, that whole arc of that story.
You do strangle each other a bunch.
Yeah, it is very accurate. Whether or not, you know, whether or not we can say the Death Palace thing is accurate.
Yeah, that part.
Well, okay, so there's a certain point to which we have to remember that he is a white man who is talking about people who are not white.
Yeah, very much so.
And he's in the 1910, so like, I'm pretty sure that had something to do with it.
It's like, here's a great setting for this.
Yeah, exactly. I'm almost certain that LaRue, the original writer, he's like, I need something exotic. The Ottomans. Okay. Their royals strangle each other. I'm sure I could give them a death palace and no one will think anything else of it.
I mean, like, in 1910, nobody was given a crap. I mean, when did the pulps start? Because that was another thing I was going to say, start pretty quick after that if they weren't already going at that time.
I think pulps started turning up in the 1880s, I think.
Oh, really? Okay, then they were already going. So yeah, this is like concurrent to pulp crap, so.
Yeah, it depends on how you define pulp. It may even be, because before the pulps got going, you had essentially, you know, broadleaf pamphlets, were like, you know, little pamphlets that were basically like, hey, here's like, you know, here's, you know, a couple cents and you get a little story you can read for the day.
I mean, right back into the whole Poe connection too, right? He would write that kind of gothic stuff.
Poe is also the same way. Yeah. You know, a lot of Poe's stories originated as little broadleafs you could buy and just, you know, read a little
Mask
thing.
Two parts. You know, in the first half, you know, the visitor arrives. The second half, everyone dies.
Right? Yeah.
Damn it, not again.
Yeah. Pretty much. But like, yeah, you're right. The timing for that. I was thinking more like the horror pulp stuff that comes a little bit later, but yeah, like there was some form of pulp going on anyway at that time, so this is kind of part and parcel of that kind of air, and it was also serialized as well before it was published as a book. So
I actually didn't know that. I didn't know it was I thought it was I didn't realize it was serialized before. I mean, I guess it makes sense for that era. A lot of things were
pretty much everything was serialized, felt like.
In a modern context, we often think of, like, Sherlock Holmes, for example, you've mentioned before, as this one monolithic thing. But reality is obviously it was serialized and published over multiple issues.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. In all kinds of places, right? In different lengths, you know, revised at times, glued together. all that stuff is part of early 20th century fiction, too. Certainly. Mm-hmm. Not just, like, Dickens and stuff, but, like, you know, all the SF authors you read that were publishing in the 20s and 30s.
They were all published in magazines.
I'm
going to
take five
right?
stories and I'm going to stitch them together, and it's going to be a novel. Sell it. Yep.
Yep. Well, so I have to talk about a couple of other things related to the LaRue. So first off, my most recent reabsorption of the story, I was a little bit kinder to it than previous. Like, I think I re-listened to it in, what was it, June of this year, something like that. And it was read by Ralph Cosham, who is, if you know Elder Scrolls Oblivion, he was Joffrey, Brother Joffrey, and then also all the Breton males. So he has a very specific way of talking. And so anytime I read in the K novel, Mazen Daran, I could only hear it in his voice with that cadence, because he has that very specific cadence. You know, like, I cannot pronounce it the way he does, but like, anyway.
I've played enough Oblivion to remember good old Joffrey.
Yeah, so it was wild hearing the LaRue novel read by Joffrey, Brother Joffrey, just having story time. So anyway, that was one thing I had to add, because narrators make a difference. And even though it was really strange hearing it out of Brother Joffrey's mouth, it did somehow add to the experience, and I came away like, okay, it's not, you know, like, I don't hate it the way I used to. I'm not like, oh my God, this is the best book ever, but I don't hate it. So at least we're getting somewhere. But the other thing I was going to say is that the very first time and every other time after that, that I've read the LaRue, there's a couple of things that just blow my mind every time. Mm. When we get to the torture room and he's got like, here's a big torture room and it's got like trees and lions and what? And mirrors and it's hot and like, what?
It has a very unreliable narrator kind of thing going on. Uh-huh. And he says like, oh, the count went nuts. You know, he kind of like lost it first. And then like, and then I lost it. And then I went into, it's like, okay, I guess. Like that was really like the low point of believability. Is it that he would get right?
It was definitely before that point though, where the Persian is talking to, I think it's Raoul.
Yeah.
And he's just like, and Eric can do this and hold your hand up to the level of your eyes because the Punjab loss. And you're like, what?
Right. What? Yeah, exactly.
What nonsense are you in this? Like 10 pages of just like Daroga just going, and then he can do this and he can do this thing too. And then back in Mazenderan, he did blah, blah, blah. Or sorry, Mazenderan. Okay. Yeah. I got to say it with the.
That is going to make me sigh in exasperation.
You got to hear that audiobook. It's great.
I really do now. Because knowing that it's narrated by him, I really want to hear that.
Ralph Cosham, I'm telling you. So. So yeah, so Eric was in Persia in the K novel and making mirror rooms and death palaces and stuff. And then like the Shah tells Daroga, "You're the best person for the job because he's sly and he won't expect you. I want you
you're
to go
his
kill
friend,
him.
Basically.
Yeah, you're his friend. Go kill him." And so instead of killing him, he's like, you've got to go, Eric. I'm going to try to do my best to put them off your trail. Bye. And, you know, does his best, but still ends up serving jail time and is put out of commission and out of the story for a while as a result. So after that, Eric flees and then goes back to France and goes actually back to his home, which I had forgotten until I reread it. I forgot that he went home. He went back to his original house to go find his mom and see what was going on with her, or like, you know, he actually expected that she had left and that his house was basically taken over by vagrants because there was evidence of people living there. And he's like, surely she's not still there. Well, turns out that she had died just a few days earlier, right before he came home. And so he never got to see her again or whatever. But then he's like, but why was she here? And his mom's friend says, she, you know, he's like, well, didn't she marry the doctor and go off and have children? And she says, no, after you left, she was heartbroken and she kept all of your things and she thought of you every day and she stayed alone in this house until she died.
Yeah.
So that's
very much, and you know, part of me really wonders, like, you know, was it her own guilt that trapped her there, or was it some lingering effect of essentially Eric's enchantment?
Yeah, I mean, there's not really a way to know, but there is one theme that is very true to this book. Literally everything Eric tries to do, like, it might be okay for a while sometimes in certain instances, like when he's building stuff, like he's an architect and everything, but then it all goes to shit at some point and everything blows up and turns into a tragedy whenever he's involved. It's like, you know, he left so that she could be happy and free and she remained, you know, enslaved to him for the rest of her life, more or less. So after that happens, he's like, well, I wanted to do an opera house, you know, and she had wanted an opera house at this particular location. And I think I'm going to sign up for the Grand Prix to see if I can get the commission for the opera house in Paris, only to find out in a newspaper that somebody else already got the commission and everything was over with and he was too late for that too. So then he goes to Paris and he's like, I'm going to stubbornly try to get my way anyway. And he discusses everything with Garnier, who is the guy who has the architect who has the commission for the opera house. And Garnier is a stand-up dude. He doesn't want to take a bribe, but Eric ends up going to sign himself up as a contractor, and the agreement is he will be the contractor. He will have a lot of say in what's going on. In return, Eric, who has all of these jewels and all of this money from his time in Persia, will fund stuff once the government, because this is a government job, once the government stops giving him money for it. So in the middle of all of that, there is the revolution, there is war, and
the communards.
Yeah, exactly. All of that stuff happens. And Eric is hanging out, because Eric, being the contractor, is able to also work himself on the site, and he himself is building all of his underground lair and stuff. He's already planning that. And
Eric,
so he
you're
just
in charge of the underground lake and the
yeah. Well, they struck water. They struck part of the Seine, and they had to create like an you know like a way to kind of contain it, because to try to dry it out and drain it would have been like more than what they could handle. And they've already got the site. They've already started, you know, excavating. They didn't have a choice, and that lake is there because of reasons. Anyway, it's explained. So while all the war and the revolution and stuff happens, Eric is just holed up in his underground lair, because they've already put the foundation and they're, you know, partially done on the building at this point. So he's underground and he's fine. And then eventually, like 15 years pass of working on this building, having it be interrupted by the changing of the government, and then, you know, the war and the this and that and the other. Eventually, they finally finish it. Eric has no more money left, and Garnier goes off to go be architecture dude over there. And then Eric's like, I have no more creative drive after working on this for 15 years. I am exhausted of the world of man. I hate everybody. I'm going to live down here in this little cavern that I've created, and I'm going to decorate it like it's a funeral parlor. I'm going to have morning candles, and those are going to be my lights. I'm going to sleep in a coffin.
He goes the whole nine yards.
He's like, this is because, like, he had had a joke, the way that it's written by Kay, he had had a joke with Garnier about, because Garnier is like, you know, you keep working so much, everybody's worried that you're going to work yourself to death. And then he's like, you know, like, oh, you mean like they'd be relieved if I died or whatever. And then Garnier's like, you know, don't make this building your tomb. And so he took that and went, oh, what a brilliant idea. I think I shall, actually.
You're an actual genius. Well done. I shall implement this at once.
Yeah. So then he decides he's going to go ahead and do the thing. So he does the thing and rolls with it.
Next door, I'll have a room full of mirrors. And next door to that, it's going to be a totally normal living room. That's just the way we do it down here. I'm an architect.
Yep. And, oh, I forgot to mention, he'd already become addicted to opium. And then after opium, he found morphine. And so he's a morphine addict. Used to be an opium addict. So he's got more in common with Sherlock Holmes than one might imagine.
Initially. Yeah.
And he's long and gangly and knows how to do everything. And anyway, so he's a morphine addict as well. So that's a thing that is decaying him further as he continues to live. So the opera house gets finished, and he decides that he has like one little dude who has been his lackey since, I don't know, 20 years ago at this point. And, you know, this guy is kind of chained to him because he has a family with like 9 children or something like that. And he needs to put all of them through, you know, college and whatever. And so Eric provides very well for him in exchange for this guy going and obtaining whatever sundries he wants, and also a supply of morphine and whatever. So he tells this dude, I need you to be my link to the world. I don't actually want to go out and go do shopping. So, you know, you be my personal shopper. I'll pay you 10,000 francs a month. Well, then as he's sitting there thinking about it, he's like, you know, I don't actually have enough money to give him 10,000 francs a month indefinitely. I need to figure out what I'm going to do. And then he's like, well, I need to have the very best clothes that are hand-tailored, and I have to have the best books on my shelves. So I can't possibly live on anything less than 10,000 francs a month myself. And so he decides on a bill for the opera house of 20,000 francs. And it's because of his very lavish and expensive tastes, thanks to living in Persia. And also the fact that he has his little lackey buddy that he is trying to put this guy's kids through school and everything, because he feels bad that this guy is kind of broken because he has been a victim of Eric's voice for the last 20 years. So.
Also, I feel like we should clarify, by the way, because we keep doing this. We keep jumping back between the Ottomans and Persia. The two are completely different.
Well, in the K book, isn't it Persia? They don't say Ottomans. They say Persia.
Do they? I don't remember.
Yeah, they say Persia.
I'll check.
It doesn't say Ottomans. It says Persia.
Okay, then that was my bad earlier when I said Ottomans. It must be if it was the Persians, it was the Persians. Because I know Alex and I both have jumped back and forth to those two.
It has that context of like the imperial rule of a centralized Muslim empire.
Right? Yeah, that's fair.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, like the Daroga is called the Persian.
I mean, they would probably call them Muslims or something at that time. I don't know.
You're bringing it up again. You know, early 20th century white dude. Right. He'd probably call everyone. He'd probably call everyone who was Muslim a Persian. Right. He wouldn't know the difference.
Well, I mean, he would have been like. Well, I mean, he may have known the difference between Persian and Arab. Right, that would have been a distinction. They're both Muslims.
Maybe. Yeah. I don't know. I don't know how much credit to give him.
Well, that's true. Yeah. I'm just saying that would
you
have
might
been
know the difference.
I'm just saying I think that would have been a distinction at the time. But I have no idea whether he was making it or not. Like, yeah.
Well, either way, whoever they are, in the K book, it is Persian. Yeah. It is Persia. Fair. It is Persian. So that's who
it is
in the K book.
I just love it because in the Wuru part, all of this is just like, you know, the managers have to give him 20,000 francs. And it's this whole setup for this, like, magician business that happens. Mm-hmm. Like the sleight of hand and the trapdoors. And he's everywhere, and he's nowhere, and is the envelope full or not? And all this stuff is like, what is this about? Oh, he's like the general master of every kind of performance, right? Like, one part of that is stage magic, right? Another part is singing. Another part is
ventriloquism. Being able to pick pockets and put stuff into pockets.
Stage magic, right? But also, like, you know, making the set what he wants it to be, right? Like, he has an entire, you know, he very carefully manages the stage for all of the confrontations that he has in the novel, too, right? Like, here's my torture room full of mirrors. Here's my, you know, pretend domestic room that I'm going to take Christine to, right? He has all, like, he's presented in this way that makes him, you know, the master of all the stuff of, like, manipulating what everyone around him sees, right? The Persian is the only one that can penetrate all the flim-flam and the illusions that he's putting out.
The Persian very much is, honestly, the closest thing to a true friend that Eric ever really has in his life, to be honest. Barring the dog, obviously.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and the thing about it is there is a part where he is talking to Christine. Eric is talking to Christine in the K novel, and she's talking about, oh, well, not, I don't remember exactly. I think she had seen his face or something, and then he puts the mask back on, and then, you know, they were having a conversation about real, you know, real things versus imaginary things. And she was talking in terms of, like, her father built up all of these castles in the air for her and then died and left her. And she's basically this, like, kind of broken person who's not really 100% operating in the same realm as anybody else, you know, and kind of disillusioned because she's used to those illusions, if you will. And so there is a point where Eric is like, you might find some of those illusions acceptable, and was like kind of hopeful because he's like, I would really like to not have to show you my face because I don't want to show anybody my face, but I would like to present something to you, you know. So
it's, you know, it's very much a tailor-made situation for him. He's like, oh, you like illusions, you like, you know, fantasy. I can do this.
Yeah. And he kind of goes back and forth in the K novel, because, like, it does actually cover in relatively brief terms compared to the rest of the book what's going on during the actual LaRue novel. And so you get to see Eric, and he's having all these internal feelings of, like, I'm old enough to be your father. I shouldn't be doing, like, what? No, bad. And then he's like, but I kind of, like, I want to mentor her and I want to guide her, but I'm also in love with her because I only have one type, you know, yeah. And that's my type, you know, and that kind of a thing. And at one point or another, he even says to Raul, like, take care of my child. And at first it reads like he's talking about Christine until you find out that no, actually he ends up having a child with Christine. So,
yeah.
So that was pretty good. But then too, Christine, you get to see a little bit more inside her head, and you get to see how she really is like a broken toy. And like, there's a point where Eric is reflecting on it and reflecting on her and going, you know what? You know, the Vicomte de Chagny has like a natural right to go after her and want to be with her, but I don't think he realizes what the prize is here, because she's broken. She was broken when I found her. She's going to keep being broken and fragile, and she's going to need a lot more than what anybody else will need. And this is going to be like a lifetime commitment of trying to cope with her needing to be fathered as much as loved, you know, like romantic love.
There's very much a case of like, he's looking at Raul going, you see the pretty woman. I see the broken one.
Yeah. Yeah. And Christine is shown to actually love Eric and actually love Raul in different ways, you know, to different degrees. And her relationship with Eric is super, like, you know, he has the power over her with the voice and all of that. But also she swept up into the illusions because she was predisposed to that because of the damage from her father. There's like a lot of family related trauma really that goes on in here.
It's kind of an overarching theme for that entire thing.
It is, until it gets kind of healed at the very end, where the father is like, you know, letting the son be free, and the son is like very good and all of that. Like, it's all kind of rectified at the end, but like everything along the way is tragedy.
I really want to finish reading this now.
The K novel is very much worth finishing. Yeah. It's a grand ride, and like I said, the characters, every character from the most minor one to the most grandiose one is a treat to interact with as a reader.
It really feels like, I would have said prior to this podcast that it seemed like a second half to the story. Really seems to have more enveloped it in a way that is pretty interesting.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? Like, it really kind of both precedes and complements it in a way that is that I kind of want to do. And then I would like to see like the revisionist version, you know, like Raoul's rights or something like that.
I think that has been addressed in a few
different
times. That
sounds awesome. I would like to see the entire range of everything. It sounds amazing.
Well, there is an Andrew Lloyd Webber musical called Love Never Dies, which I did watch like in a theater. And it was released in 2010, I believe. It is based on more or less the last little tidbit of the K novel, in that Eric and Christine have a child and Christine gets married to Raul.
Yeah.
Everything after that changes because Raul is a gambler and a drunkard, and he gambles away all of his money, and they go to America to start over fresh. And she gets into vaudeville or something like that. It's awesome. Real wacky. And then ends up like Eric is still alive somehow in this. And then ends up meeting his son, but then gets shot by Raul. And I don't know. It's a whole weird
thing.
I can totally go for that, because he, like, the death scene in LaRue is not convincing.
No, it's not.
That's the biggest contrast between Kay and LaRue, is that Kay definitively declares Eric to have died.
Eric got screwed to death. Yeah. He was dying, and then Christine came, and then the Persian's like, you don't want to go in there, Raul. Raul shows up, and he's like, where's my woman? And then Persian's like, you don't want to go in there, Raul. They're locked in there by themselves. Leave them alone. Why? What were they doing right before you left? And then the Persian's like, kissing? And then Raul's like, wow. And Persian's like, well, here's the thing. If you really love Christine, you have to love her even after this, knowing what you do and whatever. And, you know, you also have to raise Eric's child, by the way. Have fun.
Sure.
You know? So
Farewell.
I don't know.
Well, I mean, the thing is that at the end of the book, Raoul actually really loves Charles and is like, he's gonna carry on the Shang Yi name and no one's ever gonna know, and that's fine. He's indispensable, he's wonderful. You know, this is your legacy, Eric. I wish I could talk to you, Eric, and tell you.
Yeah, all things aside, like, in a weird way, like, you know, there's a frequent joke about, you know, various characters and triangles in media, because they should be polycules, or they are a polycule. This is a really strange polycule where it's like, if Eric had survived, this might have actually worked out for all of them.
Yeah, I mean, you know, but by the way, the way that Kay had written it, he was already basically dying because of all of his various problems from morphine and everything at that point. So
yeah, and that's one of the things I was talking about at the very start of all this. With you know, we often see the Phantom, especially since the 90s with Anne Rice and everything, we see the Phantom as this dashing, you know, kind of anti-hero almost. Whereas with Kay, it's very much she's like, no, he is. This is the end of the line for this man. He has worn himself thin, and even when he tries to fight Raoul, he's kind of falling on himself because his body just can't take it anymore.
Well, and the thing about it, too, is that in the LaRue, it's just like, what, he died of a broken heart? Like, I know that's a thing, but boy, that's real, like, unconvincing. So, I mean, like, you know, yes, he could, but, like, it's a lot more practical to say he died of a broken heart and morphine.
Like, yeah. You know? Too much morphine, too much sex, apparently, and emotional damage.
Right. Right. So, but, yeah, it is interesting, though, because throughout the entire book, there's also this undercurrent of his, like, sexual frustration, because it's not like he's without desires, but at the same time, he has zero way to actually, you know, express that desire to anyone effectively, because the only people, and I think somebody actually tells him this at one point, the only people who would be interested in him are people who want him as a curiosity, just because they have, like, weird fetishes.
Well, it's literally his first sexual experience is with the, you know, the slave, his enslaver at the start of the story when he's like 13 or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, it's literally a matter of, well, I can fuck you because I have all the power. It's like, his first sexual experience is literally just a continuation of his abuse.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so, like, that's just a lot. And that's probably also another reason why, because of all the abuse he suffered, the reason why, number one, he's obsessed with having control of things, but also why his person that he wants, you know, that he is interested in, his type, is somebody who is controllable, malleable, and, like, you know, childlike, that, you know, he can have more control over instead of the other way around. Like, they can't abuse him. He can, you know, be fair-minded and whatever, and potentially have, like, a nice relationship with them because they aren't powerful in a way that is going to do harm to him.
He very much has the control in the relationship, which to him is a good thing because it prevents him from being hurt.
Yeah, and I mean, like, in every relationship that he
has... Well, that isn't the way that works.
no, but I'm not trying to justify it. I'm saying that's how his mind works.
No, but, like, it doesn't even work for him. He winds up hurt very much. Like,
fair. Yeah, I mean...
He miscalculated. Yeah.
Yeah, there are short parts in the book where he has a situation where someone else is all too willing to give up their decisions and their whatever to him, let him take care of it, because he's very good at doing that. And codependent as heck, like, he's a codependency monster is what he is.
Really,
you
want
to talk about him being a monster in any way, it's codependence that he is a monster. He just wants everyone to be dependent on him, and I'll take care of everything, and they can't possibly leave me because they need me too much.
Yeah, he seeks their affection through dependency.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's really, like, and you could also say that that's exactly the reason why he likes his animals, too. They don't judge him, but also they're dependent on him. So, and they don't challenge him. So, yeah. But, like, it goes into the psychology in such a way that it's very convincing, but it's also, you have a lot more affection for all of the characters. Like, I like Raoul so much better in the K than I do the original, or basically any other version I've seen him.
Yeah, Raoul's honestly kind of
a sympathetic character in LaRue.
No, he's not. No. He the K is the only case where I can think of where he's actually portrayed as sympathetic and also being sympathetic towards Christine.
And eventually even to Eric. I mean,
yeah, even to Eric. Yeah. And Eric's child, Charles. In every other medium I've seen him in, he's incredibly capricious. It's very much a case of, you know, Christine is a fancy bauble, effectively.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And whereas Kay gives him a much bigger chance to kind of flesh that out and explain, like, no, there's actual genuine affection here. He's not a horrible human being.
Oh, you know what? I just thought about something. So Raoul's
horrible to be in LaRue. He just seemed like callow.
Yeah.
Right? Like,
yeah. Yeah, that's fair.
He's the guy who is in over his head in a way that he can't even understand for the entire time. You know what
yeah.
I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, so the thing I had to say, though, is I just realized this. So Raoul's parents died. All he has is an older brother who is very, very overindulgent and lets him do whatever he wants. Raoul is the spoiled little child, just like Madeline. So if they really had survived to be a polycule, I mean, like,
oh, no.
Hey, there's somebody wrote that. Somebody wrote it.
I guarantee you somebody wrote that. There's something online somewhere. Oh, no. Or if not, then we just inspired it.
Well, and then another thing I wanted to add is that in the K, Eric is always doing stuff where he's like making gadgets and you know, he's already created electrical apparatus before it was like widely used independently on his own doing all of this. And so there's a point where Christine is...
I forgot about that.
Well, yeah. And there's a point where Christine is looking at everything and she's like, you know, you really are like a man of the future. And I'm just like, somebody has, you know, I haven't seen a phantom in the future before, but you know what? He would be a scientist in a future as like a scientist, artist, musician, whatever, like add scientist in there to all of the rest of the, or his pedigree. You know?
Oh, yeah, no, the phantom story, if someone wanted to, and obviously I don't think anyone's done this yet that I know of, could easily be translated into a modern setting. And hell, look at how much VR is taking off. Imagine applying, you know, not just VR, but also altered reality, AR. You know, you could easily apply that sort of thing to a Phantom story and create a modern version of the Phantom, every bit as enchanting as the original.
Yeah, and who, like, maybe he is some dark critter person somewhere, and, like, his illusions are all in his online presentation or his VR presentation or whatever. So yeah, you could go in a lot of different directions with this, but
it really is the origin of kind of like the illusionist mastermind villain, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah,
like he's the original one of those that I can think of.
I mean, I'm sure if we dug into if we delved into folklore, I'm sure we'd find plenty of other examples.
Nothing's ever original. I know.
But in terms of our modern influences, right. He's definitely the most well known for what we, you know, I mean, he even, like I said, even in a lot of ways, he serves as an archetype for what we perceive to be a vampire-like character. Uh-huh. He is very much an origin point for a lot of our darker, more, you know, like almost like dark deviant kind of mastermind character.
He's like a Joker, like the Joker, yeah. Right? Because he's the guy who goes ahead and just fills the basement with gunpowder, just in case. He needs yeah. To blow everyone up, right? Like,
oh, and I have to say though, Slade, like when I was reading and he's talking to Christine, his sense mm-hmm. of dry sarcasm yeah. just so echoes you that I could just hear your voice yeah. talking about, you know, like where she's like, you know, he made a comment that, you know, insinuated that he had blown up the chandelier, and then she's like, "What? You did that?" And he's like, "Well, the chandelier wasn't going to just jump off the wall by itself, now, was it?" just
Should I be offended or complimented by this comparison? I can't tell.
It's great. It definitely sounds like you, though. Go back and read those parts where he's like getting sarcastic with Christine, and you'll hear it. You'll hear. I heard your voice.
Oh God, that is my kind of humor.
Yeah, it is. It is. Well, anyway, we are reaching our deadline. We're going to turn into a pumpkin here. And that's also apropos of Halloween. So that's cool.
I do have pumpkins to carve.
Yeah. Well, let's do some wrap up thoughts about like LaRue and Kay and the whatever phantom influence overall. So, Alex, let me know. Tell us. What are your thoughts about LaRue's phantom?
I super enjoyed the chance to read something that had some proper gothic horror in it, which is what that's the kind of character the Phantom is. That's mm-hmm. that's what he's properly inhabiting. But like, I was surprised at how much other stuff that he brought in, right? Mm-hmm. In terms of the, I'm a journalist. I'm a, you know, I'm a music writer. I'm like all the, you know, I'm a detective in this, you know, I have a Sherlock Holmes figure in this story too. Like, I'm just going to bring this all together. And it really feels like that is what's so irresistible about that as a, what made it break through as a work of popular fiction, right?
Mm-hmm.
In the way that, like, it really kind of just put it into the canon of the kind of stuff like, you know, like other French stuff, right? That kind of transcends boundaries in that way, or that has this sprightly, popular, entertaining quality to it. Like, you know, Three Musketeers and all the Zola stuff of the 19th century. And it's like, oh, I've updated this thing for a more modern setting, Paris Opera, you know, and mm-hmm. a more, you know, a dramatic telling with, you know, all kinds of scary stuff in it. That was enough to sell the silent movie to me as well. I think that is absolutely worth watching. Mm-hmm. There's so much stuff in there that is just absolutely striking to look at. You could go get it off of archive.org, I think. And even though it's kind of, you know, 1% as wordy as the novel, like in terms of the mood that it sets and the way that you can kind of see the ballerinas and the prima donna and the, you know, the stuffed shirts of the managers, you know, getting flummoxed by, you know, Eric throwing envelopes in from off, you know, off screen and stuff. It's absolutely wonderful. Like, it was great. I love to see something that was such a effective mixture of genres at a time when nobody had that in mind, right? It was just whatever kind of broke through to capture everyone's imagination. And this is just one of those things that has stuck around forever, right? And I've seen the modern musical, but I saw it as a teenager and I mm-hmm. barely remember it. But mm-hmm. even as a work of fiction that is 100 years old plus, it's worth it. And I totally intend to read the K novel just because it sounds fascinating.
It is really worth a read, especially if you enjoyed any version of Phantom, you know, like if you've, you know, watched the Lon Chaney, or if you watched the musical or the musical movie version, or if you read the original LaRue and you like that, then you should definitely check out the K novel.
Eric is a real anti-hero archetype in a way that just a glance at him will resonate to you, right? No matter what time you happen to be in, as long as it's after Lon Chaney and LaRue, it'll be recognizable.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. For sure. So, Slade, how about you? What are some wrap-up thoughts about Phantom, Phantom by Susan Kay, Phantom the original, Phantom other versions?
Well, I think I completely agree with what Alex is saying, just how the original Phantom, one of the reasons why that story has survived is because it is such an effective blending of different genres. You know, all the different genres of that time kind of got crammed together in this in a very unique way that isn't, you know, at least not in popular fiction, hasn't really survived in other form and other pieces from that time.
Mm.
And I love Kay's revisiting of it. You know, the fact that she goes in there and looks at it and goes, hey, we have a story here, but it's kind of bare bones in parts. What if we actually gave all this, you know, detail? What if we went in there and gave it emotion? What if we gave it, you know, flesh? And she does a wonderful job of executing that, you know, that mission. And does so in a way that keeps the Phantom himself in a very much that sort of semi-monstrous form, that ghoulish form that he was originally intended to have, that we've kind of lost since the 90s, especially, where he's become more of, you know, the dark, hot, pretty boy who, you know, has, you know, some scarring on him. And I adore just how much, especially with Kay and also the original LaRue, how dark it is. Like, it never really neither one of them really shy away from that. It's like, yes, the Phantom has his beauty to him, his voice especially, but he is still a killer.
Yeah, no problem murdering that guy at the beginning of the novel.
Yeah, exactly. Like, yeah, it's just, you know, the callous disregard for life there, combined with the absolute, you know, the beauty of his character, his talents, we'll say, is really fun and just fascinating blending of, you know, the dichotomy of it, the kind of yin and yang almost of this is, you know, he has these, he's wonderfully talented, but at the same time is incredibly callous towards the frailty of life.
Mm-hmm. And really, after rereading the Phantom book again, it makes me want to go find the other couple of things that Susan Kay wrote just to see how those are treated, because she really not just digs into the material of LaRue, but then, you know, digs into very, very deeply into the psychologies of the characters and gives them, you know, breathes life into them in such a way that I haven't ever seen anyone who picks up a kind of sparse book, you know, like sparsely described set of characters or a shallowly described it's set like of characters.
The epilogue, and, seriously. Yeah. And it's just like, this is the outline for the story. And mm-hmm. it was incredible to see what she was doing with it. Yeah.
Susan, especially with this book specifically, it's essentially, I mean, if we really want to do it, you know, break it down to its core, it's basically just a glorified fan fiction, but it is so masterfully done that it just stands on its own, both alongside and separate from the original.
So much so that it's been considered, like I've said at the top, Phantom canon by fans of
Which is exactly why, you know, it's kind of the highest compliment you can get as someone who is, you know, if you're taking a setting that's not yours, characters that aren't yours, and revisiting them and fleshing them out, that's, you know, just from personal experience especially, that is the highest compliment you can get from your readership mm-hmm. to say that, like, this is part of the lore.
Mm-hmm. And it's really surprising to me that they just never did a reprint. They never even did an ebook version of it. Like, I would have thought they would have done, like, an official ebook at least.
For whatever reason, Kay's writing is really hard to find. I remember mm-hmm. when I first read The Phantom, I actually went to go find more of her work. She's a wonderful writer. I don't know if she just never published her stuff or if she only did a couple books, but she did. There's not a lot of stuff from her available, and none of it's in print.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I want to say that somewhere like in Sweden or something, the Phantom book was only ever published once, and never again. And so it's extremely hard to find. Over in certain countries, especially, like, if you think it's hard to find here,
right?
You know? So
good luck finding it in like Japan or Switzerland or something.
yeah. So
falling right out of the publishing world. It's a shame.
Yeah, pretty
definitely much. Ebook out there. I agree.
Yeah. So that's unfortunate. So I don't know. Maybe I'll dig up a link to it or something and then put it in the show notes so that way folks can get a hold of an e version at the very least. Although I do. The money's not even going to go to the author at this point anyway, because it's all used versions. So, I'll go ahead and put an ebook link. Also, on the note of the Lonchini movie, I don't remember if I said this earlier. I do not believe I did on the actual episode proper. We will be covering on Fireheart Media, on the Monster Dear Monster podcast, we will be talking about the Lonchini Phantom of the Opera, as well as the Robert Englund Phantom horror film from the 80s. And then also there's
Alex laughs in joy.
Yeah, I know.
Delightful.
And then there's also a Chinese film that I don't know when it was released, and I'm not sure if it is horror or not. If it is, then it will also make an appearance on there that is some kind of rendition of Phantom as well. We will be covering that at some point in the future. Monster Dear Monster's schedule kind of goes wherever it wants. So sometime, keep an eye out. In the meantime, though, where can folks find you, Alex? Anywhere? Can they find you on the internet? And if not, what do you want to plug?
I don't think Java's Discord, probably. if you want to plug anything, I would plug Alzabo Soup, which is my favorite literary analysis podcast, which looks at Gene Wolfe novels and other mm-hmm. things in between. And I've been a fan of theirs for 5 years, and I think about them whenever I talk books with you on this one. So
cool, sounds cool and neat. And Slade, where can people find you on the internet?
I'm pretty easy to find. If you're on DeviantArt, you can find me as Slingblade87. If you're on Instagram or TikTok, it's Granite Ghost, and on Twitter, it's just the Slade. It's pretty easy to find me.
You know, branding, man. You got to get branding going. Because, like, I'm Jolichon in all the places, including Jolichon.place, where this podcast can be found.
I am well aware, and I just don't bother. I'm not trying to brand myself. I just exist on the internet at this point. If I'll consult you should I decide to re-up my branding game.
That's okay. Luckily for everybody listening, I will have links to things in the show notes as usual. So, on that note, that is all for now, folks. Until next time, take care of yourself and remember to smile. Jolichon's Place is brought to you by Fireheart Media. If you enjoyed the show, please share this and all of our episodes with friends and remember to rate and review us on your podcast platform of choice. Word of mouth is the only way we grow. If you like, you can also kick us a few bucks to help us keep the lights on at ko-fi.com/Fireheart Media. Check out our other show, Monster Deer Monster, a monster exploration podcast, at monsterdeer.monster. Music composed and produced by Jake Lionheart with additional guitars and mixed by Spencer Smith. Follow along with my adventures via jolichon.place or find me at jolichon in places on the net.